This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 120 was recorded on May 31st, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Today's show will be a long one, but a good one. Our regularly scheduled feature interview guest is Nomi Prinz, author of Collusion, the story of how central banks around the world colluded to prop up asset markets. We'll discuss the history, effects, and side effects of quantitative easing, not just in the United States, but around the globe. But wait, there's more. With the carnage that began last Friday in crude oil markets, we also wanted to bring you an update on energy markets, what we can expect next, and where the market's headed from here. So we tapped our friend Pat Hemsworth, a veteran commercial broker in energy markets, for a second feature-length interview all about what's going on with crude oil. Both of those interviews and much more are coming up in this week's Macro Voices.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 seems to have been range-bound here within about a 40 S&P point range for a better part of, it seems almost a month. We got a little bit of volatility here on the news from Europe and Italy, but nothing's moving any big way. What's your take here on the S&P 500?
Well, the way I interpret this whole story is, you know, the first half of May, we were rallying pretty nicely. And what broke the back of that rally was the breakout on the 10-year Treasury yields past 3.05, that red line in the sand where everybody feared once it goes past there, it's never coming back. Well, then it did come back. And not only did it come back, but we're down to considerably lower numbers. We were in the 2.70s earlier this week. We're back up over around 2.83 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. We got the relief on treasuries, and that still didn't restart the rally, and we're seeing more downside. I guess in the grand scheme of things, I'd say that we're still in the same general big picture, which is summer rally, trying to see how far it can get. The idea we had at one point of maybe there will be new all-time highs before it was over, I don't see that at this point. I'm even wondering if we can get back to 2,800 again before it's over. I thought we were headed to 2,850, maybe higher, or even a retest of the previous high. Looks to me like, you know, we're really not seeing much upside. So anything could change at any moment, but it seems to me like this market is kind of sluggish, and nothing is really helping to get it moving higher. So I wonder when the next big draft to the downside is coming and when we're going to see new lower lows. But right now, we're just trading sideways.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because just a few trading sessions ago, we saw the dollar index do a perfect test of the 95 level, which is where the highs were back in October and November, and rejected right there with the quick little snapback in the euro. With us now trading around this 94 handle, is this where the dollar index takes a break? What's your take here?
Well, once again, and I emphasize once again, that's what everybody's saying is, okay, look at that rejection of 95. That was a key technical level. It was a previous high. You know, that okay, that's it. It's over. You know, the dollar's going to crash from here. And I guess the way I react to that is they may be right. The same people that are saying it now have said it two or three times in this dollar rally, and they've been wrong on previous occasions because it's just powered higher. Of course, we're taking a pause here. It's a technical level where it makes sense to be taking a pause. This rally in the dollar, Patrick, has been relentless since the middle of April. And, you know, okay, we hit a key level at 95, and we're all the way back down to 94. It was time to take a pause. Now, of course, that could be the top. It could be that we're about to crash to 85. But you know what? I think that as I read the tape, I see no reason to allow this one handle of downside to invoke panic. It looks to me like a perfectly natural pullback in a healthy upward rally. Of course, a lot of people, including Juliet DeClercq, have made very articulate bearish arguments for the dollar. They think it's set to reverse. Maybe they're going to be proven right, but I don't think that this small move from 95 down to 94 necessarily, you know, puts the nail in the coffin for the dollar index. I think that all we're seeing here is a perfectly healthy pullback. Whether or not it's the beginning of a major reversal, I don't think there's any reason to conclude that quite yet.
So, Eric, let's move on to crude oil, because that's where all the action has been. Obviously, for many weeks, you've been suggesting that finally, when we hit some sort of short-term high, we'd see some sort of a throwback in this oil market. But what a big move. What's your take on this? What happened here over the weekend?
Well, let's start with what happened. Clearly, you know, as we said on the program a few weeks ago, Saudi Arabia for a while said that they didn't want to see higher oil prices. Then for the last few weeks, they've been pretty public and pretty clear saying they welcomed higher oil prices. Suddenly, there's another reversal where Saudi Arabia and Russia together last Friday said, hey, we're thinking about reducing this cutback that we've been engaged in at our June meeting coming up in just a few weeks now, and not continuing the cuts in crude oil for as long as was originally planned, because we're concerned that the market's getting a little bit ahead of itself. Now, that's an exact 180 in terms of policy, but it's like the third about face that they've done in the last month. And you've got to ask yourself, what the heck is going on? I don't believe that these guys are disorganized and can't make up their mind. Something's going on behind the scenes. And I asked myself, you know, what could this be? Here's one crazy scenario that occurred to me. What if President Trump called up his new best friend, Mohammed bin Salman, and said, look, I need a little bit of political gain from, if I tweet and say I want oil prices to go down and you play ball with me, it's going to help me politically. We're coming into election season again. That would kind of help me out. And listen, buddy, if you want the price up, don't worry. Just wait till you find out what we have in store for Iran. You'll get your price bump. Just trust me on this. Now, I'm just completely guessing. I have no way, Patrick, of knowing whether something like that could be in play. My point is, it feels like something's going on behind the scenes, because I don't think the Saudis or the Russians are stupid. And frankly, they look kind of stupid because they've reversed their position three or four times in the last month on whether they want higher prices or lower prices. I don't think they can't make up their minds. I think that there's more to the picture than meets the eye. I just have no idea what that is. So we'll have to see. Quite a few analysts, though, are saying, hey, even in the face of these comments from Saudi Arabia and Russia saying that they might dial back on the production cuts, a lot of analysts are saying, hey, it seems like with everything that's going on between Iran and Venezuela, they're forced to cut more than they want to. And even if everybody else continues to pedal as fast as they can, there's still going to be a shortage. There's still reason for there to be more upside in this rally. Goldman Sachs was just out this last couple of days with a research note saying effectively this rally is not done regardless, you know, fade the comments from Saudi Arabia and Russia.
How did the inventory numbers influence the price this week?
Well, it was a big surprise because expectations had been set for a build, which would have been bearish. And that expectation of a lot of analysts was reinforced by the American Petroleum Institute's report that came out. And of course, everything is delayed this week. So it was Wednesday afternoon instead of the usual Tuesday afternoon. Everything is delayed because of the Memorial Day holiday. And they said million barrel build on inventory. And that, of course, made people think, oh boy, you know, what's going to happen? Well, DOE came out with a 3.6 million barrel drawdown on inventory of crude oil, another 556,000 barrel drawdown in Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline was a build on inventory of 534,000 barrels, so it wasn't a super huge build, but it was a build just the same. Distillates building 634,000 barrels. Now, 634,000 barrels may not sound like a super huge build, but that's actually the biggest distillate build that we've seen since February. And distillates in general, as I'm going to get into more detail on this with Pat Hemsworth, are really where a lot of this story is, because we are in a distillate shortage situation in terms of the stocks that are there. Not crude oil stocks, but the finished product with the diesel fuel and jet fuel and so forth, which are known as middle distillates. We'll save the rest of that discussion for Pat Hemsworth. So, of course, Patrick, that big unexpected drawdown was very bullish. That sent prices rocketing straight up, but frankly, it only lasted for a few minutes before they retraced fully. And there was also bearish news. Production was up again, another 44,000 barrels this week. Now, that annualizes to more than 2 million barrels per year, up to a new all-time record of 10.77 million barrels of domestic production. Exports were also up 2.2 million million barrels per day. That works out to 15.3 million barrels on the week. Very big number. And of course, those exports are oil that would have gone into inventory for a massive build in inventory if we still had the previous legal regime in which export of U.S. crude oil was not permitted. So we're seeing a really big trend there in growing exports. So overall, Patrick, you had what could have been a bullish inventory report, but as far as the way the tape is reacting to it, it spiked up and it retraced within minutes, and now we're just limping along at the end of the day here on Thursday. Looks to me like the big question is going to be what happens next, and the inventory was not enough to send things further to the upside.
So in general, though, what's your view of the direction of oil from here? I mean, we had this drop down to this 67 handle, but where does it go next?
Well, I think the big question is whether or not we take out channel support, which is right now around $66. We briefly touched below that channel the other day. We had a 65 handle briefly on May 28th. We're now at 66 spot 93. If we get below 66 even and stay there, then I think you could see a really big move continue to the downside. And I think everybody doesn't know what to make of this because on one hand, boy, really big news that Saudi Arabia and Russia suddenly are not trying to do what everybody thought they were going to do, which is to jawbone the market higher into this OPEC meeting the way they usually do for the month before OPEC. They're jawboning the market lower. Nobody thought that was going to happen. On the other hand, there are so many questions. You know, when are they going to change their mind again? They seem to change their mind every week or two. Well, what's driving this and what other surprises could be in store for us? There's a really, really big technical level. If the price were to move below 58 on WTI, that's where the bottom could really fall out. And the reason for that is it's the bottom of the range where a lot of producer hedges are struck. And what that means is that the banks that have written these cashless collar deals to allow producers to hedge their production, those options start to move into the money, and the people who wrote those options have to sell futures. And at that point, it's not discretionary. It's not a matter of somebody speculating about the price down and selling futures. It's mechanical. It gets to a certain level. They have to sell futures. That selling makes the price go lower. The lower price makes them sell more futures, and it's a self-reinforcing vicious cycle. The thing is, you got to get below 58 for that self-reinforcing vicious cycle to kick in. I will be surprised if that happens, just because everybody's saying, why did Saudi Arabia and Russia suddenly do this about face? How long is it going to last? And what else could be going on behind the scenes? My spidey senses, Patrick, are telling me anything's possible. I'm ready for a really big downside. If we break 66, I wouldn't be surprised to see selling really accelerate down to the low 60s, maybe even below 60 even. But on the other hand, Patrick, I won't be the least bit surprised if some geopolitical upset occurs, and before you know it, we're back up to new cycle highs, $75 or higher. Nothing would surprise me at this point. It feels to me like there's more going on in this market than meets the eye.
You know, the one thing I was going to ask you, because you didn't mention it in there, but it was really interesting to me to see that Brent is up today and yet WTI is down. And when the spread between Brent and WTI is now widened to over $10, what do you make of that? What do you think is the catalyst behind that?
Well, we'll get into this with Pat Hemsworth. We taped the interview with Pat on Wednesday afternoon, and you'll hear Pat and I both say, holy cow, can you believe $9 on the spread? Well, that was Wednesday. On Thursday, it moved to $11 at one point intraday. So what the heck's going on? I have a theory here, Patrick, which is the reason that most people have favored the Brent contract over the WTI contract as a speculative long is that you get a much better roll premium. In other words, there's so much backwardation in the Brent market that each time your expiring contract has to be rolled forward to the next delivery month, you're capturing a profit in the sense that you're buying the next contract at a lower price than you just liquidated the expiring contract for. The situation is opposite in the WTI market, and that's the reason that the longs don't like the WTI market. Well, guess what? For all the reasons that you disfavor WTI as a long speculative instrument, those are all reasons to favor it as a short speculative instrument. So as you see this record positioning of, what was it, 15 to 1 at the peak of speculative longs to shorts, they were long Brent. Well, what are they doing? They're closing their Brent longs, but they're not switching to Brent shorts, they're switching to WTI shorts. And I think that's what's putting so much pressure on downside in WTI that's widening the spread. Certainly, that widening spread is dramatically influencing the export numbers. Why the heck did we see a 2.2 million barrel per day export of U.S. crude oil? Well, we're seeing that because the spread is so wide that it is enticing people to export U.S. crude oil to other markets where they can command a higher price. So it all fits together. Let's save the rest of this discussion, though, for Pat Hemsworth, because we're going to get into much more detail on the Brent WTI spread in the second feature interview.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold here, because while gold hasn't really broken down badly, I would have thought, at least on that reaction of the dollar, that gold would have gotten a stronger kicker legitimately above 1300 with some momentum. Instead, we're just pivoting here around this 1300 handle, and gold seems to be just stuck in the mud. What's your take here on what's happening in gold?
Well, Patrick, I don't really have a strong opinion. You know, for the last couple of weeks since May 15th, May 16th, we've basically been trading sideways. We saw that big sell-off on May 15th that took us down at that point to about 1293. A few days later, we got all the way down to 1285, was the low so far. We managed to get back up to 1310 at one point. Now we're back down to 1302 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. It seems to me like we're just trading sideways. I think the market's waiting to see what the dollar is going to do, and also what treasury yields are going to do. I won't be surprised if the dollar rally does confirm, if it breaks, you know, decisively above 95 and we see that the rally really is still on and it didn't roll over the way the bears are saying it, it's rolling over, then I think gold goes another leg to the downside. But right now, I think we're consolidating, waiting to see what comes next.
All right, let's move on to the 10-year treasury bonds, because wow is all I have to say. We swung in 7 trading sessions, almost 35 basis points. We had a low somewhere around the 275 level. What's your take here on yields?
Well, Patrick, the first thing that I agree with is, wow, what a move. We went from, what was it, 3-spot 12 or something into the high 2-spot 70s in just a couple of weeks. And of course, this was at a time when so many people had predicted if we break out past 3-spot 05, there's no looking back. That's where the market's going to crash and we're going to move to much higher yields. Didn't happen. And, you know, the old saying, the market loves to embarrass the maximum number of people. The thing is, we thought maybe a short squeeze was starting. Either that short squeeze didn't happen, or if it did, it ran out of steam early, because we got into the high 2-spot 70s for a while. Now we're back up to 2-spot 83 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what's going on. Even Jeff Gundlach is saying now that he sees the 10-year yield being contained as long as the 30-year stays below 3-spot 22, which, of course, it is now well below it. It's about 3-spot 00. We really ought to try to get somebody from Double Line on the show to talk more about Jeff Gundlach's views. In the meantime, I don't know what to tell you other than, wow.
All right. Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, we have 2 featured interviews this week because of the big surprise in crude oil. First, author Nomi Prins will discuss central bank collusion, and then Pat Hemsworth will be on to give us an update on the energy markets. Eric's interview with Nomi Prins is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is author Nomi Prins. The new book just out is Collusion, the story of quantitative easing, not just the Federal Reserve, but central banks around the world. Nomi, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Why don't we go back to 2009? It's spring of 2009. Everybody's panicking. It seems like the sky is falling. And the Fed announces QE1. And at the time, what everybody in the industry was saying is, oh boy, money printing, this is going to lead to runaway inflation. That's going to be the risk. And of course, what's happened has been anything but runaway inflation. I think at the same time, a lot of people didn't understand. We thought the bill of goods that was sold to the public, frankly, was that they were going to be creating new money supply to benefit the general economy, to help Joe Main Street to get back on his feet. And it seems like the money that's been created has helped asset markets, but hasn't done a lot for Main Street. So what did they actually do, and why was it not inflationary the way so many people feared?
Well, actually, what they did was inflationary for asset markets, and that's the irony of it. And that's actually how we know that simply electronically conjuring money or printing money wasn't the way to sustain strategic on-the-ground growth. And so the fact that we've had over $21 trillion throughout the world, just $4.5 trillion on the side of the U.S. with the Federal Reserve manufacturing money and not becoming inflationary from an economic standpoint simply shows us how much it was really inflationary from a financial asset perspective. It did lift debt markets. It did lift stock markets. It did lift housing markets back. It just didn't trickle down into the main economy. So the fears that inflation would somehow be stoked were not really realized, because that's not where the money went. Had the money really gone into the main economy, we probably would have had inflation, and that would have probably capped the level of financial asset inflation, but it just didn't go there. Nor was it funneled in a way such that it would go there. So our biggest sign that it didn't really work to do what the narrative was that it would relate to growth is that we didn't have inflation, but we had asset inflation.
Now, the other criticism that was levied at the time, a lot of people, myself included, looked at the situation and said, okay, the central bank basically printing money to buy their own bonds. This is emerging market, end of the world stuff. It's an act of desperation. And I predicted very, very incorrectly. I thought the market's going to see through it. They're going to see that this money printing doesn't solve any real problem that led to 2008. It doesn't do anything about the corruption that existed in the falsification of bond ratings on CDOs. It doesn't fix that. It doesn't fix too much private debt in the system. It doesn't fix any of those things. It seemed to me like it was just an act of desperation that the market would see through and it wouldn't help anything. And of course, to my astonishment and a lot of people's astonishment, it's been straight up in, I think it's second longest running bull market in all time history. So why is it that the central banks were able to get away with something that, and tell me if you think I'm wrong to say it was an act of desperation that didn't really address any of the causal problems that led to the 2008 crisis. That remains my view today. What I'm kind of baffled by is how have they gotten away with it, and how have they managed to prop up markets for so long without any ill consequence? You know, we always thought someday the piper has to be paid. Well, when is the piper going to be paid? What form is that going to come in?
I completely agree with you because it was an act of desperation, and it was an act of coordinated desperation across the world. The reality was credit markets were dead. Banks weren't trusting each other. The assets, not just on their books, but the loans they had extended to other investors to buy those assets were all basically falling apart. And the Fed came in and said, you know, we'll just fund this. Here's a check, you know, call it electronic, call it printing, but here's some money to paper over that. And by the way, here are swap lines for everyone else in the world to make sure they have enough dollars so that if they or their countries have too much exposure to these assets in this particular credit problem, they'll be helped as well. So it was absolutely an act of desperation, and it was a lot of desperation. I mean, these were large sums that were taken out in QE1 and in the wake of the early part of the post-financial crisis year. But the reason the markets went up and didn't see through that is not because they believe this wasn't an act of desperation, I think, but because there was just free money being handed out. You know, it's sort of like if you're a drug addict and you know at some point you'll be clear-headed if you just get off the drugs and get your act together and sort of move forward. That's one way to do it. Or if someone's supplying you with lots of drugs and it just works and lulls you and everything else, well, then you'll take them. And this is what happened. The Fed was that sort of supplier of last resort, not a lender of last resort, of capital for the market. And by basically blowing through interest rates, keeping them at 0% in the U.S. and then globally as well, the cost of capital was so low the ability of any actual government bond to return anything of any substance was also rendered low as a result. And so the only place to go was every other asset market, for example, the stock market, and that's where the money went. So the desperation continued for 10 years in a way, because now that we're looking at so many trillions of dollars still in the books of all these central banks, they're not taking it away. That sort of security blanket for the entire financial system is still on offer. I mean, it's still there for any kind of a crash potentially to be cushioned. Or if it's not enough, then any new crash will actually blow through that cushion. That's what we're dealing with right now. It's just been going on for so long and it's so vast that it's given markets this liftoff. And if we start to get problems like credit risk that has been inflated since all the QE began, start to come to a head, defaults, delinquencies, emerging markets seeing their capital fly back out because there's just a little bit of a worry that this can't go on forever, all of that starts to culminate into a major potential credit squeeze, which ultimately can be the other leg of this crisis, and we go into decade two.
Let's talk about the scope of this globally. Why don't we start with the United States and the Federal Reserve? How much total QE has occurred between, depends, I guess, on whose system you go by, whether we had three rounds or four rounds of QE. All this money that was conjured out of thin air went to buy what assets? How much, what percentage of it was treasuries, and how much of it was mortgage-backed securities, and how much of it was anything else? And what is the status of that today? And particularly, how much is still on the balance sheet? Certainly, we know how to value treasuries, but what about mortgage-backed securities and other things whose value might be a little bit dubious as opposed to what it's marked to? How much of that is still on the Fed's balance sheet?
So at the height of the QEs, the Fed had a balance sheet of about $4.5 trillion, and that was in a combination of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And the mortgage-backed securities were something like $1.5, $1.6 trillion, and the rest were treasuries. Today, after they said they were going to taper, reduce the size of their quantitative easing portfolio in the beginning of this year, it has tapered by a whopping 0.2. So it's now at $4.3 trillion instead of $4.5 trillion is the total amount of QE assets on the books. $1.75 trillion of that is mortgage-backed securities, which, to put that in perspective, is about 26% of the entire mortgage-backed securities market. So not only is that a fairly big chunk, but that also allows the remaining mortgage-backed securities to be overvalued by virtue of the fact that this demander, the Fed, has been there for all of these years and continues to roll over its positions and sort of buy more mortgage-backed securities when they come off, although for the most part they're longer dated than the treasury securities that the Fed has on its book. The rest of the securities are U.S. treasuries, and they're kind of clustered around the 3 to 5 year maturity level. Although recently, and we've seen this, has been a bit of a yield curve flattening. They've moved a little bit out the curve. So there's a little bit of movement just from the Fed's perspective, very quietly. I'm looking at their balance sheet, sort of moving around to the 5 to 10 year and 10 year area. But that remaining bulk is in U.S. treasuries.
Now, with respect to the massive $1.6 trillion of mortgage-backed securities, do we have public data on both whether or not those are performing completely, and is the valuation just sort of what the Fed marked it to when they bought it? Is there any objective analysis of whether what they're carrying these mortgage-backed securities on their books are and what they're really worth if they were, let's say, hypothetically, we had a sale tomorrow and auctioned them to the best bidder? I have a feeling that the best bidder is probably not going to overpay beyond what the Fed is marking them to. Do we know deterministically what this stuff is really worth, or is it just kind of take the Fed's word for it?
Well, this is the catch-22 about the whole thing. We know what the Fed paid for that amount of mortgage-backed securities at the time in the initial part of QE that they purchased them. But of course, things have been rolling on and off, and they've been buying more, and things have been maturing along the way. So there's been a little bit of adjustment there. It's the kind of thing where they don't show the prices. They just show the sort of absolute value of the amount or notional mortgage-backed securities they purchased and what they value it at on their books. So every week they have a Federal Reserve report, HR 4.11, that basically shows all the assets on their book. And one of the classifications on that book is mortgage-backed securities, and it sort of breaks that down in a very minor way. It just basically says how much they've gone up or down since the last week and over the past year. So that doesn't really give you a clue as to what they're priced at on an individual basis. But the problem is, even if we did know that, which they don't report, the fact that they're buying them at the levels they're buying them at kind of creates this artificial bid for the entire mortgage-backed securities market. So even if they overvalue, you know, 26% of the market by 10%, that overvalues, let's say, on average, everything else by 2.5%. Do you know what I mean? So it's very hard to get a real sense of what the value of the market is based on the fact that the Fed likely overpaid and nearly isn't breaking down all the individual prices and, you know, what interest payments are being made and sort of what default rates are and so forth into those mortgage-backed securities. And again, even if you back analyze them by looking at other mortgage-backed securities they don't hold, they're getting a higher bid by virtue of the fact the Fed's holding the ones they're holding. So no, we don't have an absolutely clear sense of how well they're doing or how they're performing. We just know that their bid is keeping the rest of the market higher than it would otherwise be.
Now, a lot of people, including professionals in finance, I think focus so much on this just shockingly large number of $4.5 trillion of balance sheet expansion that the Federal Reserve has been through. And as you say, now it's shrinking all the way down to $4.3 trillion. It sounds like just such an unconscionably large number. People lose sight of the fact that's like a quarter of the total amount of money supply that was created globally through all of these QE programs. So let's go around the world to the other central banks, because not only did they create more cumulatively than the Fed did, but they also bought more than just their own treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. Let's go next to the ECB, the European Central Bank. What did their QE program look like? How is it different from the Fed's? And what assets did they buy at the peak, and what do they still have on their books today?
So their peak is still growing. So at the moment, they have somewhere between 5.3 and 5.5 or so trillion dollars worth of assets on their book. And they're kind of divided between different government bonds throughout the Eurozone, countries that comprise the jurisdiction the ECB is supposed to be concerned with, and then also corporate bonds that they're also purchasing. So the mix is such that it was changing. It was sort of like 20% corporate bonds and the rest government bonds, but now there's been more corporate purchases, so the percentage is going more towards corporate bonds. So they're taking on sort of more credit exposure on the books. And the way the European Central Bank actually purchases or decides how to purchase these securities is rather, well, it's kind of random, but I mean, they tend to purchase securities that are in the major countries or the more core countries in the Eurozone. So, you know, Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, France, and so forth, relative to the sort of weaker economies like Italy or Greece or Spain, although that's not entirely true. Well, I mean, it's true of Greece and Germany, but they basically choose corporates based on a lot of things that don't necessarily reflect fundamental analysis of companies. There's relationships in there that get brought up in terms of what securities they buy and so forth. They do print a weekly update as well, what they've purchased in terms of the exact corporate bonds and what they've let run off, which is none of them.
And do we know for sure what assets the ECB has? Obviously, we don't know every position, but are they transparent enough to indicate, you know, what percentage is in corporates and what percentage is in treasuries and what percentage may be somewhere else? I know some people have questioned whether or not the ECB has engaged in buying ETFs or equity securities. Do we know that for sure?
We know sort of what they're buying, like what new is coming in. And so you can sort of do the math and figure their reports aren't exactly fully clear and transparent. You can sort of back quantify how much they are holding of governments versus, say, corporates just by virtue of the fact that they published the new purchases that they've made in corporates and they published their total size. So in that respect, we can continue to see the sort of now 25 or 26% corporate percentage of their balance sheet, which is going to expand as they continue to buy corporates relative to governments. So you can kind of see it, but I mean, it's really kind of have to dig around to get the entire picture. It's not like they have this, and they could, but they don't have a chart that says, okay, this is how many governments we bought. This is how many corporates we bought. These are the maturities. These are the countries. These are the sectors. You have to really kind of do the legwork yourself, but it is sort of there.
Let's hit the Bank of Japan next. What does their program look like? How big is it and what does it contain?
So the Bank of Japan actually does have more invested in ETFs. You know, you mentioned before whether the ECB did. It's the ECB is more in corporates, although the National Bank of Switzerland, which is outside the ECB, is in equities. The Bank of Japan is a combination really of Japanese government bonds, JGBs, and ETFs. And one of the things they do also is on a bi-monthly basis, they actually show how much they're going to put into various ETFs before they do it. But that number isn't constant, so it sort of changes based on where the Bank of Japan decides to invest at that particular moment. So there's no real plan. It's just sort of like they have the ability to expand their balance sheet. Their goal is about 6 trillion yen a year on ETFs, but it's not necessarily in like 30 billion euro monthly quantities like the ECB. It's a little bit more random. But they have the largest balance sheet right now at over $5.5 trillion worth of quantitative easing. And what happened with Japan is around 2013, they kind of crossed. The Fed was still increasing its balance sheet, and the ECB sort of was increasing its balance sheet all of a sudden more quickly because they had a credit crisis in 2012 and 2011. And then the Bank of Japan came in and just blew them both away in terms of the accelerated speed of their quantitative easing from 2013 up. And that coincided with the government of Shinzo Abe coming in and wanting to have, you know, perfect economy and fiscal stimulus and all these other elements that would be benefited by an extremely loose quantitative easing policy by the Bank of Japan. And so they've really won the 2013 to now speed race in terms of quantitative easing manufacturing.
Well, if I put the Fed, ECB, and BOJ together, I come up with around $15.5 or $16 trillion of total QE programs that you've described. Where is the rest of it? Which other central banks are also engaging in QE? And how does it compare in terms of both size and type of assets that they've acquired?
Those start to drop off. You have the Bank of England that has about $800 billion worth of quantitative easing. You have the Swiss National Bank, which is somewhere around there. You have the Netherlands. You start to get like $200-300 billion here or there, which starts to add up ultimately to about $20 trillion, where you just have really the other major country central banks kicking in after the Bank of England at $800 billion, just sort of a few hundred billion here and there.
Now, I think there's a really important point here, which is that in the United States, when they announced the tapering of QE, that was the point where a lot of people predicted, okay, you wanted to know when the piper has to be paid. This is going to be it, because now suddenly they're shutting off the free lunch faucet. But when you think about it, at the time that the U.S. was tapering, the other central banks were just ramping up their activity. So on a net basis, am I correct to say that there really hasn't been any tapering of quantitative easing yet, if you consider it on a global scale, all the central banks cumulatively?
Yeah, that's correct. It's one straight line up. And obviously, if we sort of divide up who's tapering, i.e. the Fed, what happened is when the Fed, not so much tapered, but when they stopped expanding their quantitative easing program, you had a more accelerated line through that level of both the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan. So the net-net, if you added everything up, you had a continued expansion of quantitative easing across the major central banks. And then recently, as the Fed said, and we discussed it before, it's going to taper and has basically sold a whopping, you know, $200 billion off of their $4.5 trillion balance sheet, they've been able to effectively be overcompensated by the additional amount of quantitative easing coming from the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank. So net-net, it's still there, which is why this entire program, even though it began with the Fed and then was kind of exported through the rest of the major central banks, is not something that can be looked at as just the necessity of any domestic central bank or regional central bank to handle their own country. This is, or their own region. This is something that was collusive from the beginning and has been on a continued basis. And so what that allows in terms of a continued distortion in the markets is that the Federal Reserve can say, okay, we're going to taper because this policy has worked. And then A, not really taper, and B, have any shortfall in tapering be taken up by other major central banks. So, you know, as you mentioned, net-net, not only has there been no change, there's been an increase in quantitative easing through this tapering period. But what it does occur is every time a taper is suggested by either a central bank or central bank leader or, you know, the press in that country or whatever, there tends to be now more volatility coming into the markets because the expectation is that maybe this time they'll actually do it. I continue to be surprised by the fact that this is a belief that's held by anyone, because looking at the numbers, there's been no evidence that any tapering has actually occurred at all anywhere on, you know, in total. But when it is suggested, markets do tend to wobble. When it is suggested, for example, the European Central Bank will take off sort of the, you know, the tablecloth from the dishes of the corporate bonds that they're buying and they're going to crash down on it, they just come in and expand the dates of their quantitative easing. Like you, I thought that when tapering was going to start happening, there would be problems. But because it's global, there has been no tapering, so those problems haven't happened. I also thought that when the European Central Bank, who had come in and taken over for the Fed, going slower on quantitative easing, came and expanded their program and had said that a summer ago they were going to stop, that at that point, at that stopping point, there would be a definite issue and there would be more wobbles in the markets. But then they didn't stop. They just expanded it. So this also relates to the credibility of these central banks, where even if they promote the idea that what they've been doing has somehow worked relative to what their goalposts are, whether that's growth or inflation or whatever they may be, the reality is they don't really change their policy collectively.
So let's just take stock of where that leaves us, because it seems to me 10 years into this, if the goal had been, and they'll never admit that it's the goal, but if the goal had just been to prop up asset markets, you got to give them credit for the fact that that has worked. For the last 10 years, we have seen just terrific inflation or growth of both stock and bond markets. And it is just staggering the amount of money that's gone into this. Now, as you say, if you consider that the global markets really are controlled by very sophisticated investment banks that have the ability to invest globally, the easy money spigot has not yet been turned off. All that's happened is perhaps even for appearances' sake, the Fed says, hey, politically, we can't get away with this much longer. Mario, Shinzo, turn on the spigot on your end. We're going to shut ours off for appearances' sake. And of course, you can easily move that money across international borders. It still contributes to U.S. stock indices and so forth. At some point, though, those of us who don't believe in a free lunch are convinced that the piper has to be paid. So how does that come about? Do we have to wait until eventually, on a net basis, they really are tapering globally? And what happens at that point?
I think that the idea of tapering globally is far off, for a lot of reasons. That the language of all these central bank leaders, with sort of the exception of the Fed, but really if you dig into it also Jerome Powell, is that growth is actually slowing all of a sudden. So the ones that were talking about tapering, or the ones that were at least covered in the press as potentially talking about tapering, have really sort of dialed back. So Kuroda at the Bank of Japan has basically said, well, yeah, but inflation's not really high, so I'm just going to keep doing this. And Mario Draghi has said, well, growth's not really high. And Mark Carney, who runs the Bank of England, was anticipated widely by literally every analyst in the UK and around the world to be raising rates 2 weeks ago, and then didn't because he said that growth had slowed down. And so they changed their goalposts, from, say, being full employment to slow growth. Inflation's not really our benchmarks, to, in the Fed's case, a lot of internal senior people at the Fed are saying, well, even if we do get inflation at 2%, because that's about where it's hovering in the US relative to other countries, well, maybe 2% isn't the right benchmark. So they keep on coming up with excuses to continue to push QE. So I don't think that's going away anytime soon. But I think the problem, and one of the reasons they're continuing to push it, comes from credit, which is the problem in literally every crash. Is that all, there's, even with the level of cheapness of debt, whether it's public debt or whether it's corporate debt throughout the world right now, and the leverage that's been taken out since the financial crisis because money's been so cheap for so long, there has to be a point at which the true, not simply just growth of a company or growth of the corporate environment or growth of the economy, completely mismatches the sort of asset inflation of the financial part of the world, that there'll be a moment where, that one company or that one sector, and it's starting with retail, and it happened with energy, and then oil prices will pop back up for different geopolitical reasons and so forth. But enough sectors, enough consumers, enough countries start to be unable to pay even the cheap level of debt that they have. And if that happens kind of simultaneously, which is how credit bubbles burst, it's not usually one company or one sector. It's a simultaneous kind of squeeze across lots of different areas, or that relate to different areas. That's when we start to have market downturns, and that's when you start to have spreads blow out, and that's when you start to have money taken out of the stock market in order to chase those spreads back in and so forth. And that's when you start to have more problems. But I just think that right now, even though instead of rising volatility and emerging market outflows and so forth are all pointing to that eventuality, the fact that you have this enormous amount of unlimited quantitative easing potential, and when I say unlimited, I mean there is no limit by any of the central bankers on themselves, it really does keep everything in check, which only means this kind of snowball continues to get bigger and bigger as it's pushed, up to the top of some hill that we can't really see the top of, but is there before it comes back down again. And all those credit bubbles pop first, and then it sort of oozes into the rest of the asset classes.
Now, for the first 8 years or so, all that could happen is asset markets went up, and that was both bonds and stocks. But Treasury yields bottomed almost 2 years ago now, and it seems like maybe we're seeing the beginning of a backing up of interest rates. We've had a number of expert guests on the program who've said, hey, there's really an important line in the sand around 3.05 on the U.S. 10-year. We're past that now. Or 3.25 on the 30-year. There hasn't been a close above the 100-month moving average on a monthly basis on the 30-year since the early 80s. And it would take a 3.25 print in order to break that record. We're at 3.20 now, 5 basis points away. So we're getting really close to some very, very strong bearish signals in the bond market. Are these indications that this quantitative experiment is finally reached a point where it can't sustain itself and it's all about to blow up? Or is this just par for the course?
We are in extremely uncharted territory. So levels relative to money supply creation are really in completely uncharted waters. So saying, you know, 320, 325 print means something, it would have had we not had 20 trillion or so amount of supply that was then leveraged into much more than that, sort of keeping the world up. I think, and this is why looking at the Fed's balance sheet is interesting, and I just started doing this because of all of that conversation about, you know, the yield curve flattening and sort of rates going up in the long end and so forth. That said, we also had some auctions last week that were very well subscribed, which sort of pushed rates back down because of that psychology of those levels. And I'm also seeing that the Fed's moving some of its purchases around to the longer end. That happened in Japan. What Japan did was it started out with quantitative easing in terms of just moving the, you know, rates down and buying bonds in the lower part of the yield curve. And then it started doing the you know, quantitative easing with a twist. And what that simply meant was also buying securities in the longer end of the curve. So effectively flattening out the yield curve, but from the far side downward. And I think if the rates going up in the longer end, which do, yes, indicate people's lack of confidence in real growth in terms of, you know, bond power, bond purchasing power in the future, start to manifest, I personally think if it gets to be too bad that given the environment we're in right now, the Fed's going to come in and increase the buying on that part of the yield curve and bring those rates down. But that is not conventional opinion. I just think it's something in the arsenal of what the Fed could do. If it seemed like having rates too high too quickly would create these credit problems that I was just talking about before. So I don't have that crystal ball, but this is the one thing where I'm not sure. It's like, I wasn't sure that tapering was going to, I knew tapering wasn't going to happen globally, but you know, I sort of believed when certain central banks said that they would at least stop purchasing that they would. And of course they didn't. And so there is now a precedent for central banks to just expand the nature of their quantitative easing. And so the Fed does have that at its disposal, which would take yields down at the higher end of the curve.
If you had asked 100 finance professionals back in the spring of 2009, a hypothetical question, which is, if central bankers put their minds to it, do you think they could prop asset markets straight up for 10 years straight in a straight line and have nothing go wrong and without the whole thing blowing up in their face? I think 90% of them at least would have said, no, that's impossible. So far, that has worked. They've gotten away with this. Does it mean that there really is not going to be a price to be paid at some point? Is it actually possible for central banks to, you know, create prosperity this way? Or I don't know if it's prosperity for Main Street, but certainly for Wall Street it has been. Or does there have to be a point where it all blows up? And if so, how do you think it goes down? What's the mechanism? What are the consequences? And who pays the price?
Yeah, so I mean, this is why my subtitle is How Central Bankers Rigged the World, because that is what's gone on for the last 10 years. It's been a bona fide rigging of the financial markets by just dumping cash into them and by converting all these central banks that were primarily regulators of monetary policy and their, you know, supposed day jobs into portfolio managers, into hedge fund operators. And that's really changed the dynamics of the system and of financial markets. And I was like those other 90%. I mean, I didn't think this could continue for as long as it did. again, I think when the European Central Bank expanded beyond their initial thoughts of quantitative easing, my guess as to how long this would continue increased dramatically, because it just shows that there will be a moment in 2019 where there's going to be a shifting of a couple of the deck chairs in the central bank community, possibly in Europe. You might get a hawkish person coming in from Germany to take over Mario Draghi's job and so forth. But I think ultimately the sort of coordinated effort of these central banks can keep the markets up for a number of years longer, but with more fractures coming into play of the ones that we all envisioned would happen, which is that you can't continue to allow the leverage to increase, you know, forget the height of stock markets, but the leverage in the debt markets to increase indefinitely, because at some point, even cheap debt has to be repaid. And so what we're seeing right now, I think, is the beginning of that sort of reckoning coming in with, for example, money flowing out of the emerging markets and the emerging market ETFs as quickly as it has in the last few months, because those are the markets that had, on a government basis, had more risk attached to them to begin with, and yet were able to attract massively oversubscribed bond issuances in the process of having cheap money available to them from a global basis, linking it to, you know, dollar-based debt and so forth from a corporate basis. And that just expanded the leverage in the world. And I think that will crack first. What cracks first? I mean, the thing that's the weakest. And leverage is not real. I mean, leverage is borrowed. And at some point, there has to be a repayment of borrowed money, even if what it's borrowed upon is going to continue to borrow more. And so I think that's the fracture. That's what happens, is you just have massive credit problems across corporates, across emerging market governments, across consumers in these countries, because they haven't been propped up in a sort of wage versus cost basis, the way the markets have been propped up and banks have been propped up from a sort of additional, you know, deluge of capital basis. And I think all of that starts happening around the same time. Yeah, so when you start seeing that there's studies where almost half of the households, for example, in the United States, basically can't make, you know, an extra month of payments on just their general expenses if they have to, those are problems on the consumer side. You see retail companies closing. Those are problems on the consumer side. You see corporates starting to, you know, have delinquent payments. That's a problem on the corporate side. And then you see emerging market governments start to have problems repaying or not being able to expand as quickly their borrowing agenda. Then that starts to be a problem on that level. So, I mean, I think all of this will happen around the same time. When it does happen, it will be large and it will be credit-based.
And do you think that there necessarily has to be a big bad event at that point, or do central bankers respond and say, okay, we got to print some more money? And of course, it may not be technically money printing, but they are conjuring money supply out of thin air without any natural wealth creation behind it. If that seems to be what worked before, I would think they would just go back to their old tricks and do it again and probably get away with it for a while longer. Is there something at some point that prevents them from being able to use more QE to continue the party, so to speak?
Well, functionally, no. There's nothing to prevent them to expand their balance sheets, like literally nothing. There's no limitation. There's no legislation. There's no sort of external body that's going to make them stop at a certain level. I mean, the actual answer is there's no limitation. So one wonders why they haven't done more. I think they've done everything they can do, which is why, yes, when those things start to happen, I do think the European Central Bank will open themselves to more corporates. So will Bank of Japan. The Fed will have a little bit more of a political problem, perhaps, in sort of selling that. But I think that's why they're positioning themselves out the yield curve. I mean, I think these things will happen, but still you have that point where it's like the Titanic. It's like you're sinking, but, you know, there's some life rafts and sort of the rich people are jumping on, they're getting there and they're sort of getting away. But then how many, at some point, there's just not enough left to sort of get everyone out. And I think at some point we might get to a level where the manufacturer quantitative easing, which has and I think will continue to increase globally, isn't enough to make up for the sort of fractures that are happening throughout the credit world. That's when things start to implode. And like I said before, I don't think that's tomorrow. I just think we're seeing those signs. I just think that central bankers are very clear that when there's any reason they can attach themselves to allow them to continue quantitative easing, they will do that. The rates are a little bit of an issue when rates start to go up, because there's the expectations in the market that growth is slower, that people are selling off longer term bonds or whatever it might be. And again, I think they have an arsenal to deal with some of that. And then again, we have to look at this as a speculative world. And so people who are watching what the central banks are doing from an investment standpoint, and that's not a wrong thing to do. I mean, you might as well, are watching what they're doing and they're sort of hopping on board. And so the European Central Bank decides to buy, you know, Siemens or something in Germany as a company, well, then so will other people. I mean, it's pretty well announced. And so you can sort of ride the various trades of these central banks as well. And that has the cosmetic ability to lift up certain assets, even if they're failing at their core fundamental value level.
A theory that I've had has been when this all really comes falling apart is someday when you get to secular inflation. If you start to get to a runaway inflation problem, it seems to me that although it's true that the criticism that QE was going to supposedly lead to inflation didn't happen, it's also true that they were in a very, very deeply deflationary economic backdrop at the time that they started doing the QE. It seems to me if you're already fighting runaway inflation, and you try to do more QE at that point, maybe that's the point where it exacerbates the inflation. And at that point, the central bankers' hands are tied and they can't go any farther. And that's when it all comes crashing down. Grade my term paper on that. Would you agree with that analysis? And if so, how far away do you think we are from serious runaway inflation becoming a factor? Because certainly there hasn't been much sign of it yet.
No, and again, it depends how we define inflation there. There has been inflation discussed in asset prices. There's been inflation in, you know, university costs, healthcare costs. There's been inflation in certain basic, let's say, needs, less in things like retail or sort of areas that are actually deflating and that sort of thing. There's been inflation recently in oil prices, but not enough to really make the difference. And there's been cheap car loans, so people are still buying cars. So, I mean, everything is kind of keeping itself in check, and inflation in general throughout the developed world, throughout where these main economic central banks operate, is still really, really low. And even in the U.S., as it's kind of approaching the 1.9 or so percent on any given month, if you look back at the last 10 years, you know, yeah, it's been at 2.3, it's been at 1.5, it's been at 2.2, it's been at 1.0, you know, it's still bobbling around very low levels. And it's even lower in Japan and in Europe, and now sort of moving that way in the U.K. and so in the major economies. So yes, though, if you had that change, or if inflation was computed in such a way that it actually reflected people's cost of living inflation and the financial markets inflation, then you probably would see stronger inflation. But the way it's computed, we're still at very low levels. And again, every time we get near the 2% magical level in any one of these areas, central bankers come in and discuss whether or not that level means anything and whether or not they should increase it, such that they can continue quantitative easing. So I agree with your thesis. What's just weird about this particular environment is that, you know, we're dealing with this sort of unlimited, not just in terms of the amount of quantitative easing, but in the sort of nature and quality of it to continue to morph. It's sort of very new beast to everything. And I think as it can morph around the yield curve or morph around the credit curve, it can sort of keep up with some stuff. But ultimately, yeah, if prices were to go up too high because there's too much money in the markets chasing real goods, then, yeah, perhaps we would see that things would shift. But this money isn't really necessarily chasing real goods. It's chasing financial assets. And that's very different.
Nomi, due to time limitations, we've only had the opportunity to explore a few of the topics that you cover in your new book, Collusion. Please tell our listeners what else they can expect to find and what the book is about when they read it.
Well, it is about collusion amongst the central banks and how quantitative easing has really changed the nature, not just of, and this is, I think, expanded from our conversation, the nature of the financial markets, but also geopolitical relationships, trade relationships, because amongst the major central banks and the ones that were sort of outside of that realm, for example, the People's Bank of China or the Central Bank of Brazil or Mexico, which I cover, those central banks had different issues in terms of the money they created, where it went. People's Bank of China, for example, that money went into real infrastructure development and real trade agreements with countries in the region for China to basically say, look, we're going to lend you money to, you know, Sri Lanka or wherever, Thailand, et cetera, to build in coordination, which strengthened their geopolitical ties. And so there are ramifications of central bank policy that go beyond just changing markets and actually changing the nature of economies, of diplomacy, of trade alliances, superpower hierarchies, and of voting patterns, you know, throughout a lot of these countries as well. So the themes that I cover in the book throughout the world are evolved from simply monetary and rate and currency developments into just really how the world has been restructured because of the new powerful nature of central banks moving from just monetary policy and even from just quantitative easing into being able to work with governments to really change the nature of the world.
And again, the name of the book is Collusion by Nomi Prinz, available on Amazon. Nomi, in addition to the book, you also have an excellent website, and you're also very active on Twitter. Please give our listeners both the URL for your website as well as your Twitter handle.
Sure. So it's my name. So it's www.nomiprinz.com, N-O-M-I-P-R-I-N-S.com. And the same thing on Twitter. It's at Nomi Prinz.
Nomi, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Listeners, stay tuned because we've got another second feature-length interview coming up with Pat Hemsworth, veteran crude oil trader, to talk about the huge move that we've seen in the last week in crude oil. That's coming up next as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as our second feature interview guest this week is Pat Hemsworth, commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets. Pat also has put a fantastic slide deck together. Be sure to check your research roundup email for that one. And Pat, before we dive into that slide deck, I want to start with a big picture here. You know, just a few weeks ago, we had the news come out that says Saudi Arabia wants $80 to $100 oil prices, and Saudi Arabia denied it. They said, no, we don't want that. Then a couple weeks later, we got to 80, and they said, yeah, we do want this. Wait a minute, they changed their mind. Then, of course, everybody's been paying attention since Friday. They've changed their mind again, and they don't want it. What is going on? Why is it that Saudi Arabia and Russia can't seem to make up their mind whether or not they want to try to jawbone the market higher or lower? Because I think everybody, myself included, assumed that going into this OPEC meeting at the end of June, they were going to be doing their usual game of jawboning markets higher, and all of a sudden, they're jawboning markets lower. What happened?
I think that there are a lot of things, you know, sort of percolating under the surface. I think that the Saudis are basically trying to play things by ear and try to satisfy and mollify a number of different constituencies, their own. They want to keep prices at a, stable and relatively high. They don't want to destroy the market. They want to keep the market at relatively high prices, but they don't want to cut off demand. And at the same time, sort of behind the scenes, there has been a kind of cooperative relationship developing between the Trump administration, MBS, and and Saudi leadership. In his characteristic and not so terribly subtle way, Trump tweeted the other day about OPEC prices being too high and, you know, that these fake cuts, causing the markets to be really too high, you know, that they should fix that and stop, playing around the market.
Well, Pat, I agree with you. And the thing that I've really noticed here, you know, Donald Trump has been tweeting for a long time and frankly has been ignored by a lot of people for a long time. This was the first example we've seen where President Trump tweets, I don't like oil prices. I think they should be lower. And the next day, Saudi Arabia and Russia take dramatic action. I think dramatic is not an exaggeration in order to bring prices down. Now, was that just a coincidence or does Donald Trump suddenly command that kind of influence with these guys? I guess we've got to wait and see what happens next time there's a renegade tweet in the middle of the night. But I agree with you that definitely it seems like he has more influence. Let's move on to the Iran situation. Now that Mr. Bolton is in the White House advising Mr. Trump, a lot of people don't really understand what the story is with the Iran sanctions, where it stands. So moving on to slide two of your slide deck, tell us about the situation in Iran and what we can expect there.
The United States is resuming full sanctions on Iran. And what that means is there's two different phases. One is a 60-day phase, which sets into effect certain kinds of some metals and a couple of other autos and a few other commodities. We have to stop trading with them, and everyone who we trade with has to stop trading with Iran and those products. But as far as all energy, it's after 180 days. So that's November. Now, one of the things that was a little confusing to some market players was, what does this really mean? If the U.S. is breaking with European allies on whether or not to reimpose sanctions, what does it mean if we disagree? And there are secondary sanctions as part of this whole program, meaning that any European company who trades with Iran, even if their governments would like them to, is subject to secondary sanctions with the United States, meaning they're cut off from U.S. financial institutions, borrowing money, financing cargoes, getting insurance. And so many European companies do not want to run into trouble with the United States in that regard. So they're complying. People didn't fully understand, I think, at first that the United States would impose secondary sanctions.
Okay, Pat, so moving on to slide 3, we're actually looking at the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures price chart. And we can see there was a very, very strong uptrend through this period when we learned that these Iranian sanctions would be reimposed. And it seems like the Iran news was contributing to that. Now we've had this breakdown in reaction to the news. And, you know, if you look at the bottom channel line that goes back to February or so, it looks like we kind of tested the bottom of the channel that's been in play and we're bouncing. So is this a dead cat bounce, or are we bottomed out here, hit the bottom of the channel and headed to new all-time highs? What comes next, and what other factors besides Iran are going to be influencing this?
I don't think it's a dead count bounce. I think that the market is absorbing an enormous amount of news and potential response from OPEC. So this uptrend here was basically created by a drawdown in inventories, good economic growth, and also on top of that, the threat of potentially withdrawing from the Iran deal. Ultimately, that happened. We had a spike, and the market actually was at all-time high historic levels in terms of open interest.
Let's talk about Venezuela next. This country has, by some measures, the biggest reserves of any nation in the world of crude oil. And I think that the production estimate of what the country's capable of in terms of its, you know, natural resources is upwards of 4 million barrels per day of production. Now, of course, they're stricken with all kinds of political problems. And as you're showing on page 4 here, they're down another million barrels per day year on year, now down to about a little less than 1.5 million barrels. I think, was it 4 million was their peak at one point? Boy, this is a really big story. Where is it headed from here, and what happens next?
Yeah, the production was about 1.8 million in November, and it's down to 1.45 now. One of the interesting things about this is, first of all, it enabled the drop-off in production from Venezuela, who is an OPEC member, enabled OPEC to over-comply, is kind of their euphemism for the loss of production from Venezuela. But in November, got these numbers from Francisco Minaldi, who's a wonderful economist who focuses on Latin America. But he put together a paper, said 1.8 million barrels a day was in November production. And out of that, only 850,000 barrels per day actually earned cash and got them currency. Now they're down to about 450,000 barrels a day because they have to pay 400 to 450,000 barrels a day is domestic consumption. 500 to 600 is payment to Russia and China. So now they're only getting 450,000 barrels a day or so that's bringing in cash, and they have huge debts. They've defaulted on a number of Chinese and Russian loans, but they have outstanding $60 billion outstanding in Treasury and PDVSA debt. So the kind of day of reckoning is coming, and it may be closer than anybody expected because of this recent Conoco development. And just recently, an international court awarded Conoco $2 billion worth of assets, and they have been taking those assets in the Caribbean, totally disrupting export and their logistical capabilities to export to the United States and in the Caribbean. Anyway, it's looking pretty ugly. There are many analysts who are now, like Wood Mackenzie is one of them, who are now looking for a drop below a million barrels a day, at which point the Chinese and Russians pretty much own their what production they have, and a default could be imminent.
I want to tie this story of Venezuela into the bigger OPEC picture, because what a few analysts are starting to say now is they're saying, look, all this nonsense from OPEC about how we're going to, you know, reduce our production or increase our production, we can manage the price, we're in control of everything. They're saying, look, it's all a bunch of BS. What's really going on here is Venezuela is losing so much production that OPEC can no longer keep up. Everybody else, even though they don't admit it, is already pedaling as fast as they can. They can't increase their production more than they already are. Venezuela is probably going to continue to fall apart, and that situation, unfortunately for the people of that country, is likely to continue to devolve as long as Maduro is in office there, and he's just reelected himself, some say without votes, but he still won as far as he's concerned.
Yeah.
You know, it really makes you wonder, is all of this talk from OPEC about how they control the price by managing their production real, or are they faking it, and are they actually hiding the fact that they're already pedaling as fast as they can?
As far as OPEC's ability to respond to this, I think they're not pedaling as fast as they can, but they may be unable to completely satisfy the market with Venezuela and also the Iranian losses. It will be a challenge for them. They still have spare capacity, but it may take some time to get that on. I think they're trying to organize that now. I think it's harder than they make it look.
On the next couple of slides, we're looking at inventories. First, on page 5, we're looking at OECD oil stocks. So that's not just the United States, but all of the OECD countries. Then on the following page 6, you're looking at the U.S. crude oil inventories. Tell us what's going on here. It seems like, you know, we pretty clearly hit the bottom already, and we've been slowly recovering from that low inventory situation that we had back in January.
Yes, OPEC basically uses a 5-year average as a kind of benchmark for trying to maintain their production, and they tried to get the excess inventory down to the 5-year average and were successful. So this is the OECD stock level. It shows the breakout of the Americas, Europe, and Asia Pacific. But the next page shows the U.S. inventories, and it's kind of interesting because they were massive and came down very dramatically. And now we see a little bit of an uptick here with the increase of Permian Basin. We're now up to 10.7 million barrels. It's beginning to show up in our own inventories. But the bigger picture is that we've really worked down a significant amount of global inventories.
Moving on to page 7, talking about the market response, give us the overall picture. How is the market responding to the current situation in inventories? And is inventories going to continue to be the big topic that drives prices? I mean, it seems like that's all we've been hearing about for the last several months.
You know, right now we have decent demand with world economic activity, pretty robust. Demand is good. Forward day supply has been reduced. Inventories have been reduced. And now we'll be looking at the market's response to the interruption of supply and OPEC's attempt to meet that supply. And we'll be watching inventories.
Pat, one of the things that has perplexed a lot of people in the oil market is the Brent-WTI spread. The difference between the price of oil in the United States and the world price is growing more than $9 today. What's going on? And as we look at slide number 8 here, you've got a picture here that shows us what's going on with some of the infrastructure and pipelines in the United States. How does this fit into the story, and what else is affecting that spread?
Well, the United States is now the largest crude oil producer in the world. We're producing 10.7 million barrels a day. The growth has been out of the Permian Basin. The Permian Basin feeds to a number of different storage points, Cushing and or the refining centers in the Gulf. So what's happened is that the infrastructure for the pipeline infrastructure and the gathering and connecting infrastructure is inadequate to move the amounts of crude that are being produced right now. So what's happened is that we have local glut in the United States in the Permian Basin in Midland, Texas. And so that's measured by the spread between Midland and Cushing, which is now at $13, which is absolutely extraordinary, $13 difference in price. So it's WTI minus for similar quality crudes. That means that we're exporting as much as we can. Our average export rate, I believe, is 1.6 million barrels a day for 2018, but we've significantly went over that. So what's happened is this glut that's reflected in our domestic spreads is also being reflected in the differential between Brent and WTI. Brent really does not have a storage infrastructure. I mean, we're producing here and we're storing here, so we're seeing the weakness here. So that's why we're seeing this tremendous movement in the WTI Brent.
Pat, let's move on to a subject that is very near and dear to my heart, which is forward curves in crude oil, both Brent and WTI. And since we're getting into an area that is a little bit technical, that certainly commodity traders like you and I understand very well, I want to just explain a little bit of background. What this chart on slide 11 is showing us is at various different dates. So the green series was taken on one date, which is shown on the legend on the top right corner there. The orange series is taken on another date. The red series is taken on another date. These are snapshots at various different points in time of all of the different prices. Each little dot represents the price of one delivery contract. So the June delivery contract is one dot, the next one is the July contract, then the August and September and October and November. And you see that there are characteristic shapes to these trends. That general form of the price goes down the later out you go is called backwardation. If it was going the other direction the way it did on that purple curve at the bottom, especially in the right-hand side where it's sloping upward, that's called contango. What are these curves telling us right now about this market, and why did you choose these various different dates that you have here on slide 11?
Well, I wanted to choose the purple one on the bottom. That's 1 year ago. And I guess probably the most important ones are look at this purple one versus the orange one, which is now. And then say the green one is a week ago. What we saw a week ago was much higher prices and a much steeper backwardation. What we're seeing now are lower prices and a flattening of the curve. And that makes sense in terms of the expectation that near term we'll have the supply that's coming from Iran into the market, but further along the curve we will have supply interruptions, specifically in November, as a result of the Iranian sanctions. So what we should expect to see is a flattening of the curve where the front end begins to weaken versus the back end. So that's what I'm looking for. And if we just look at the contrast, to say a week ago, the market really has moved quite a bit. And I'm expecting that we'll continue to see that trend.
Now, there's something that I find very interesting about the difference between WTI and Brent, which is normally this pattern we see with, say, the green series at the top of the page on page 11, is even though structurally this is very clearly a curve in backwardation, just that first one-month spread, those first two dots, there's a tiny bit of contango there. And the way that's always been explained to me is because we have this great big huge storage facility in Cushing, Oklahoma, there's a storage premium associated with that, we tend to get a little bit of contango right at the beginning of the curve, which reflects storage costs in Cushing. But you don't see that phenomenon of a little bit of contango at the front of the curve in Brent, or at least not normally. But if I move on to slide 12, we are seeing that little bit of contango at the front of the curve in the Brent series, which to my eye is very unusual. I'm used to Brent looking the way the red series looks on page 12, where basically if it's going to be in backwardation, the whole thing's in backwardation. We're seeing this WTI-like hook at the front of the curve. What's going on there?
This is what I think happened. We were seeing 5 weeks of liquidation by large money market players and funds in WTI, and I think they went to Brent. We were weakening here in the United States because of the glut in Midland, but that wasn't happening in Brent. And so I think what happened was funds loaded up on the front end, and then as we got closer to expiration, very quickly had to get out. So I think we had a rather dramatic move this time in Brent because of heavy fund liquidation. That normally doesn't happen in Brent, but it did happen this time.
I want to ask you a follow-on to that, because if I look at something like the red series here on page 12, which is what we're used to seeing in Brent, That made Brent the favorite poster child of the longs. Speculative longs were saying, hey, I could be long WTI and pay a little bit of premium in contango when I roll that contract at the end of the month, or I could be long Brent and get paid a roll premium in the form of capturing a little bit of backwardation each time that I roll the contract forward. So this massive, massive speculative long interest was mostly in Brent because of the roll premium. And I've had a theory, which I'm very interested to get your feedback on, which is, I think as everybody got to the point where they said, okay, this market has topped now, it's time to, for the specs to reverse position and go short, I think these guys are saying, wait a minute, if I'm going to go from long to short, I'm not going to short Brent for the exact same reason that I didn't want to be long WTI. I do want to be short WTI. So I'm going to cover and close my long position in Brent, but I'm going to open a short in WTI. And my theory has been it's that activity which has blown the spread out in the last week or two. What do you think? Am I onto something there?
I totally agree. You gave me the missing piece, the missing link to the whole story. It's really the speculators and the funds prefer to make some money on the roll, and they could do that in Brent. They couldn't do it in WTI. So the speculative, the drive was towards Brent for the funds to make money on the roll. And when they got out, as things began to turn in Brent, but yes, you're absolutely right. I do believe that looking for that roll premium is what brought in the specs and the funds into Brent rather than WTI.
Now let's move on to the actual finished products and how those inventories come into this picture. On the next page on slide 13, you're looking at distillate inventories in the United States. And for any listeners who aren't familiar, distillates is just a collection. It refers to diesel fuel, jet fuel, kerosene, and other things that from a chemical standpoint are known as middle distillates that come from crude oil, not including gasoline. Why do you have the distillates chart here, and what is it telling us?
If we go back just a little bit to the story about U.S. production, all this new production out of Permian Basin is relatively light API. And what has happened is that U.S. refineries are trying to use this cheap U.S. shale crude. What's happening, though, is that it's producing much less distillate in the whole refining process. So we're getting less inventories have been drawn down for some time because of excellent export demand from Mexico and from Latin America. So we have very low inventories right now in distillate, and it's showing up in the price. It's a combination of the crude, good export demand, and less distillate being produced. And there's very, very good margins right now in the U.S. for distillate.
So that chart was distillate inventories, and I see here for our listeners' reference, you have all of the other gasoline stocks and so forth. RBOB, of course, is the gasoline contract for anybody who's not familiar with that. Give us the overall picture. Basically, we've got strong demand for finished products that seems to be driving this rally. Where do you think we're headed in terms of both the products and crude oil? What's the big picture here in terms of what our listeners should expect from the market?
Well, we talked a lot about crude oil, and we talked a lot about the supply situation in crude oil, but the demand part of the picture is equally as important. We wouldn't have a bull market if we didn't have very, very strong product demand and low inventories. That's pretty much it.
Well, Pat, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before we close, tell our listeners briefly what you do at Paragon Global Markets, and how can our institutional investor audience contact you if they're interested in your services?
I am a Senior Vice President at Paragon Global Markets, and I am a broker. I'm responsible for commodity business for institutional hedgers. And also, we have very good services here for traders who are looking to speculate in the markets and to make money by trading futures. I can be reached at 212-921-1301. I'm also on Twitter at P. Hemsworth, and I'm very active there. And my ICE chat is P. Hemsworth 1.
Pat, thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, what a great interview with Nomi. I've always been a firm believer that the way we measure inflation has never been a good reflection as to the impact from central banks and the asset price inflation they're creating through the exercise that they've taken through quantitative easing. It was a really interesting interview just to get the insights on that. What did you take away from it?
Well, I thought that both Nomi and Pat gave us fantastic interviews. I don't really have any particular reaction other than a lot of great points from both of them. I enjoyed learning the particulars of the various different central banks around the world. The fact that the Fed, those massive, massive numbers of balance sheet expansion that everybody focuses on, the fact that that's less than one quarter of the total global quantitative easing picture is just a scary thought. And of course, Pat's perspective on the crude oil market is so timely. Of course, we used up, folks, all of our time, so we're not going to have a post-game segment this week since we had two feature interviews. We do need your help, though, promoting the show, so please forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. Tell your friends about Macro Voices, and most importantly, if you haven't done so already, register your free account at macrovoices.com. It only takes a few minutes, doesn't cost anything. We won't spam you or try to sell anything. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the best content that we can get, including presentations and supplemental information from our feature interview guests, as was the case with Pat Hemsworth's chartbook this week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, first off, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Nomi Prins. You'll also find the chart book for Pat Hemsworth's interview. There's an article from Zero Hedge as well titled Everything Has Gone Wrong, George Soros Warning About Another Major Financial Crisis. There's also a neat article from David Rosenberg titled The Three Little Letters That Could Spell Big Trouble for the Canadian Dollar in the Years Ahead. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment.
Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.